You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.
Good evening, folks. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins coming to you from the Sea Ranch, California on this lovely sunny afternoon, May 23, 2015. This week's podcast from Pituitary World News will be the first in a series on the medical management of acromegaly. I saw my first patient with acromegaly about 27 years ago. I was watching a movie the other night, Force 10 from Navarone, that starred, amongst others, Harrison Ford, but also Richard Kiel, who most of you know from the Bond films as Jaws. He was in that film, and it might have been, I guess, around 1978, 79 when that film was produced, but that probably was about the first time that I had ever laid eyes on someone, or at least the image of someone who had the disease process. And I actually saw Mr. Kiel on the streets of San Francisco about 5 to 7 years ago. And it was clear over the period of time from the 1970s until the mid-2000s that his body had been literally ravaged by the disease process. And it got me to thinking about the concept of how treatment for acromegaly has changed over the time of my career, beginning about 27, 28 years ago to the present day. I want to talk about some of those secular trends in treatment and how we have literally changed the natural history of treated disease of acromegaly as a result of advances in our understanding of the disease process, new pharmacological therapies, and improved surgical techniques. Now, when I was in my fellowship training at Hopkins in the early 1990s, the only real things that we could do for patients with acromegaly were surgery and then conventional radiotherapy. If you didn't get control with either one of those two treatments, you were basically destined to suffer the long-term consequences of the disease with all of the manifestations thereof, including heart failure, diabetes mellitus, severe arthropathy, progressive disfigurement, sleep apnea, colon cancer, etc. Bromocriptine, a dopamine agonist drug, was available to treat acromegaly, but only normalized the growth hormone and IGF-1 levels in about 10% of patients. So there really wasn't much we could do in 1990. Then, in the early 1990s, the subcutaneous form of somatostatin became available, and some patients would respond to this drug. Generally speaking, it was about 30 to 60% of patients could have normalization of the IGF-1. The drug had to be administered every 6 to 8 hours, sometimes by continuous infusion. And those were not viable options for most patients. So around the turn of the century, the company that made somatostatin made a long-acting release version of that and studied that and showed that you could get control of acromegaly with an injection administered about every 28 days. While this was revolutionary, it meant that most patients had to come to their physician's office about every month to have an injection, and that was inconvenient for a large number of patients, especially since most patients do not live near pituitary centers where physicians who had experience using the drug practiced medicine. Since the introduction of Sandostatin LAR, two other somatostatin logs are now available. They include lanreotide and pasreotide. We'll talk about the somatostatin analogs in a separate podcast at a later date. Also, cabergoline was developed to treat hyperprolactinemia. It's another dopamine agonist drug, better tolerated, more effective than bromocriptine. It too has been studied in acromegaly and represents an oral option for management. And I will devote a separate podcast to dopamine agonist drugs as well. And we also have pegvisomant, which is a growth hormone receptor antagonist, otherwise known as a growth hormone receptor blocker, that's effective in the management of acromegaly. That will also be the subject of a separate podcast in the future. So basically, there are six drugs that we can use to treat acromegaly, and a couple of more coming down the pipeline. So this is a revolution in management compared to when I started my endocrinology training at Johns Hopkins in 1990. And of course, any advance leads to consternation. There's been a lot of interest in these medications and trying to decide which drug to use first and when. And I'll try to give you some of the insights in this series of podcasts about how I go about selecting drugs, when I use combination therapy, when I abandon a drug and start another one, etc. So with this podcast and in subsequent ones, I'll largely be referring to the way we do things in the United States and the way that I do things based on my perceptions, having taken care of large numbers of patients with acromegaly over more than a quarter of a century. Most of you know that pituitary tumors come in several size varieties. There are the microadenomas less than a centimeter, the macroadenomas a centimeter or greater. I use the term giant macroadenoma for those tumors greater than 4 centimeter. And tumors are also classified according to their invasiveness, whether they're invading local bone or surrounding tissues or the dura, and also graded as to whether or not they extend into the suprasellar region. Now, it stands to reason that those bigger tumors that are more invasive are difficult to treat and to certainly cure by surgery, whereas the smaller tumors are more readily controlled. That's not always the case because some small tumors are rather aggressive and require multiple treatment modalities over time. In general, in the United States, if you have surgery for acromegaly, surgery still being in our country the treatment option of choice, provided that you're healthy enough to undergo surgery, we expect that about 60% of macroadenomas will be rendered disease-free, whereas about 90% of microadenomas will enter remission and be considered disease-free. Of those patients who have invasive tumors, the rate of success falls off pretty dramatically depending on the size of the tumor, with a less likelihood of success with larger tumors and also those that are rather more invasive. One thing is for certain about acromegaly and growth hormone-producing tumors and the likelihood of success of surgery, and that is more experienced surgeons are more likely to be able to resect a tumor and render a patient disease-free. So my advice is to seek out the most experienced physician that you can who might perform that transsphenoidal surgical procedure if you have acromegaly and are awaiting surgery, or if you need repeat surgery, or even a determination as to whether or not you should undergo repeat surgery. Seek out an experienced physician. At our institution, we see a lot of people who come to us having been operated on elsewhere, still with active acromegaly, and a simple second operation usually induces remission in a majority of these patients. So really and truly, you need to find an experienced surgeon if you have this hormone-secreting neoplasm of the pituitary gland. One of my recent patients illustrates this point. He was diagnosed with acromegaly, saw a neurosurgeon in a town about 4 hours away. They looked at the MRI and told him they didn't think it could help him because they couldn't find a tumor, and they recommended medical therapy. He sought counsel at my institution by coming to see me and had an obvious 1.5 centimeter pituitary adenoma located inferior to the pituitary filling part of the sphenoid sinus and also the clivus, which is the base of the sphenoid bone. Obvious tumor. Inexperienced neurosurgeon didn't see the tumor, recommended medical therapy, and I think that we'll be able to cure this gentleman with surgery. So see an experienced surgeon and give yourself the best opportunity to perhaps get a cure from your disease process. While there have been studies looking at the use of somatostatin analogs in the management of patients who have failed surgery, And half these studies show that you get better outcomes of surgery or a greater likelihood of success with surgery, while the other half show no differences. But generally, medications are reserved for those people who fail an operation or are so sick from other disease processes that they're not candidates for surgery in the first place. But one other treatment modality to consider is that of radiotherapy, which I mentioned earlier. Radiotherapy comes in basically two major flavors, if you will. One of them is conventional or old-fashioned radiotherapy, where a small dose of radiation is administered daily, 5 days a week for about 5 weeks to a certain dose to try to kill the pituitary tumor or at least stop its growth. And then the other form is that of stereotactic radiotherapy, most often gamma knife radiosurgery, but CyberKnife and computerized photon knife are other forms of stereotactic radiotherapy. They all have about the same outcomes. But radiotherapy used to be administered to everybody with acromegaly who had surgery but residual disease, and now there's a impetus to move it to patients who only fail medical therapy. My approach is somewhere in the middle of these two extremes, where I use radiotherapy in a number of patients, depending on the amount of residual tumor, the aggressiveness of the tumor, whether or not gamma knife radiosurgery can be used, and the age of the patient. Generally speaking, for those people over age 45, I recommend adjunctive radiotherapy if they were not rendered disease-free with surgery, whereas those patients who are under age 45, I recommend medical therapy first and radiotherapy only if there's tumor progression or if they're resistant to the medical treatments or if they have a very aggressive neoplasm based on certain immunostains that we can do at the time their tumor is removed at surgery. Stereotactic radiosurgery is usually reserved for those patients who have very small tumor volumes that are far enough away from the visual pathways or the hypothalamus of the brain, for example. So we can give a large dose in one or two treatment fractions. Whereas conventional radiotherapy is usually used for those patients who have very large, invasive, or widespread tumors that have multiple areas that need to be treated. In general, I think of either of these treatment modalities as controlling the growth of these tumors in about 90 to 99% of patients. The only hazard with gamma knife radiosurgery is that since it is so well defined and focused, you could treat, say, some residual tumor in the left side of the pituitary fossa, but not know there's microscopic cells on the right side, and then years down the road you may have a tumor recurrence in the area of the right side where some of those microscopic cells were located and therefore need to have additional gamma knife radiosurgery at a later date. Whereas conventional radiotherapy might take care of all the disease in one fell swoop. Still, however, my preference is to use gamma knife radiosurgery when able and conventional radiotherapy when we're not able to use gamma knife radiosurgery. Generally speaking, both of these forms of radiation will induce remission in about 70% of all patients treated. Those with gamma knife radiosurgery achieve remission earlier, with about 50% of people in remission after 3 years, whereas the 50% remission rate for conventional radiotherapy is at a later time. Some are saying 7 years, others 10 to 12 years. You also tend to get to that 70% remission rate with gamma knife radiosurgery quicker than you do with conventional radiotherapy. These differences are not meant to imply that gamma knife radiosurgery is better than conventional radiotherapy. We just need to keep in mind that the patients selected for one treatment or another are different. So if you obviously have a smaller tumor volume and are a candidate for gamma knife radiosurgery, you're probably going to go in remission from radiation sooner than will a patient who has a large amount of tumor, making a lot of growth hormone, a lot of cells that need to die off, and gets conventional radiotherapy. So you can't compare them as one form of treatment being better than the other in regards to efficacy. We do believe, however, that probably gamma knife radiosurgery with its limited radiation exposure to surrounding tissues may result in less complications. For example, the rate of hypopituitarism may be lower. The rate of tumors induced by radiation may be lower, but we probably need another 10 to 15 years of study to know if that's truly going to be the case about second neoplasms. In our practice, whether we use conventional or gamma knife radiosurgery, and this is based on some data from the University of Virginia, we tend to not co-administer the somatostatin analogs for about 2 to 3 months prior to radiotherapy and for 3 to 6 months thereafter. And that's because treatment with somatostatin analogs probably limits the effectiveness of radiation. And that brings me to, how does radiation work? Well, radiation causes damage to the DNA in the cells, and many of the cells will die off as a consequence of radiation, but probably most do not die off until they try to divide. If you will, the DNA is like planting, the radiation is like planting a smart bomb in the DNA, that when the cell starts ramping up its process of cell division and making new DNA, that's when there's a fatal error in cell function, and that cell then dies. So tumors that are very rapidly progressive or aggressive are going to probably respond to radiotherapy sooner than those tumors that have a very slow growth rate over time. And we know that if you take a somatostatin analog, that seems to slow the growth of these tumors down and put them a little bit at rest, and we don't want that while we're giving radiotherapy because we want these tumors to die off faster. So generally speaking, you should not take your somatostatin analog for a while before and after radiotherapy. So what I've tried to do is introduce you to the concept of surgery as first-line treatment, at least in the United States, followed by radiotherapy, especially in those who are older rather than younger, and then using medical therapy adjunctively. The nice thing about radiotherapy in patients with acromegaly is that ultimately you can stop the medications, whereas if you do not have radiotherapy, you'll be required to take the medications for life. At the start of the podcast, I introduced the concept of several different classes of medications. In the next few podcasts, I'll review each one of those different classes of medication and then try to summarize by putting it together as to how one can approach treating patients with acromegaly with medical management as an adjunct to surgery and radiotherapy. So once again, I'm Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, and I thank you for your time and your attention. Have a good evening.